Hi, I'm Brian McCreath, and this is The Answered Question from WCRB in Boston for January 20th, 2017. You're hearing part of Edward Elgar's Enigma Variations, as performed last weekend by the Boston Symphony Orchestra. Conductor Bramwell Tovey mentioned this particular section of the piece on last week's podcast as one example of how vivid Elgar's writing is in describing the friends he was writing about in the Enigma Variations. You can hear this entire performance of the Enigma Variations at our website, classicalwcrb.org. Each week on this podcast, you hear that kind of detail and insight from the musicians who perform each weekend on the radio during our Saturday night Boston Symphony Orchestra broadcasts and on WCRB in concert on Sunday nights. And on the podcast today, you'll hear from Juanjo Mena, who's leading the BSO this week in our Saturday broadcast, and Richard Egar, who conducts the Handel and Haydn Society on WCRB in concert. As for last week's concert, unfortunately, we can't offer more than the Elgar on demand because of restrictions imposed by the publishers of the other two pieces by Barber and Riley. But you can hear the entire concert, including Cameron Carpenter's mind-blowing encores on the Symphony Hall organ, this coming Monday night at 8 p.m. For this week, Juanjo Mena is the guest conductor in a Boston Symphony program that begins with Prokofiev's Classical Symphony and ends with Tchaikovsky's Symphony No. 4. In between, Gidon Kremer is the soloist in the violin concerto by Mieczysław Weinberg, a composer who was born in Poland and eventually settled in the Soviet Union. He was a good friend of Shostakovich, and the two of them gave each other feedback on their music all the time. This turns out to be the first time the BSO has ever played anything by Weinberg, so when I got together with Juanjo Mena after a rehearsal this week at Symphony Hall, I asked him if Weinberg was new to him, too. And the answer is, well, no. He actually heard about Weinberg first from a group of Polish musicians in Spain.
I met his music, I think, was 15 years ago, or 18 years ago, when I was chief conductor in Bilbao Symphony Orchestra, because in this orchestra were some Polish members, Polish musicians, that told me about Weinberg. And I remember I did with them in the Samber series, one of these symphonies, Samber Symphonies number 4. And it was for me the first time that I met Weinberg and was enjoying a lot. It was very beautiful and strange at the same time. But after this, I remember I talked about the concerto 10 years ago or 8 years ago with Ilya Gringuls, the possibility to do it, but we didn't do it. No? And it's for this I'm very happy to do at the end this Weinberg concerto with the maestro Gidon Kremer.
Well, the thing about it is that this is the first time the BSO has done anything by Weinberg. So that's pretty great, too, that your first time with the concerto and this entire orchestra's first time and our audience's first time. What you just said kind of makes me curious about one thing. You said that the Polish musicians in Bilbao told you about Weinberg. Do you have the sense from that Poland still kind of claims him, even though he ended up living in the Soviet Union? Is he still regarded by Polish cultural people that this is a composer that they sort of own as well?
I think they like to have his identity, no, because we're very important. They suffer a lot, of course, with the Soviet Union, but also with the Nazism, no? And this is one of the countries that is very lyrical, is very nice people, was very elegant people also. It's another concept of the Slav culture. And it's for this I like to recognize also Weinberg as a Polish composer, no? With a lot of influence of Russia, of course, it's very, very clear. And I am very delighted to do, as you told it, the first performance with Boston Symphony, this piece, because I remember 6 years ago, when I did Wooden Prince of Bartok, this was also first time for the orchestra, and it was always something exciting when the musicians and so me to do this piece. It's for this we are really waiting for this.
The other thing, though, beyond being of Polish descent, is that Weinberg was such a good friend of Shostakovich, and you can hear that somewhat in their music. Now, I read an interview with Gidon Kremer in which he said that they influenced each other a lot, but they both, in his words, maintained their clear signature. So, from your knowledge and experience, what is the signature of Weinberg that makes it a little bit different from Shostakovich?
It's true that there's a lot of influence between them, and I agree with Maestro that is also both identities were very important. No, it's very clear in the point of view of the orchestration. If we look at the Weinberg Bannon concerto is plenty of unisonance in the strings in the first movement and the last movement, and also in general. In some point of view, Shostakovich did sometimes discreetly this, but the texture sometimes in the harmony, in the contrapoint between the voices, and the is more rich in Shostakovich. It's more, developed, or more, more interesting in some point of view, no? But at the same time, the power of the unison also really cries, it's something that creates a strong energy. And also it's true that Shostakovich used this in several places. They use it, one orchestration elements in the same way, that is the snare drum, the xylophone, and the timpani, with a lot of vertical sound and contrast, no? Especially the xylophone that was very determinant also in all the Shostakovich and Anson Prokofiev symphonies.
Yeah, those are great points. I mean, just the sort of ways that they sound somewhat similar, but also the ways that Weinberg orchestrates the overall effect when you sort of step back and you experience the entire piece. I've only just learned the Weinberg myself a little bit from recordings. There's nothing that's not very personal about Shostakovich, but there's something different about Weinberg that's separate from politics. It feels like. I don't know if this is something that resonates with you. There's a very personal voice to it.
Possibly it's more Mr. voice. Yeah. It's in Shostakovich, sometimes the themes and the ideas are very clear and very well. The structure is also more academic in some point of view in Shostakovich. In Weinberg, in some moments it's crazy. It's quasi a disaster structure, and the action of the phrases change in the bar in different positions, and at the same time, sometimes the lyrical passage and the dark passage. I love, for example, the third movement is something amazing. All these sostenuto sounds, sostenuto lines, really. Also, Shostakovich used it a lot, but in Weinberg it's stable all the time, no? And Shostakovich, they go to another more tension or less tension. In him, it's very, very constantly the same tension, no? And the also second movement is a quasi a vals of similar to the Tchaikovsky vals in the first movement of Symphony 4. It's something that is non-structured. It's not a vals that you cannot recognize, but it's inside a little vice, little dramatic and dark and sadness.
Yeah. Well, you just mentioned a connection to the way that Tchaikovsky does some. Tell me about how the other pieces, the whole program was put together. Was the Weinberg sort of the starting point, and then the others, the Prokofiev and the Tchaikovsky, added on? Or how did you work through putting this program together with the BSO?
I think the question with the classical symphony, with Prokofiev symphony, to open the concert is a joy. Yeah. You know, it's something, and we have a Rus composer with a very ironic character, plenty of the details, jokes, pictures in the symphony, and it's very demanding symphony, as you know, for the musicians. But all of them like to play because it's crazy, it's open, it's fresh, it's plenty of power at the same time. No? I think with this first impression about the Rus composer, with these feelings, we go to the Weinberg. And in some point of view, it's a little dramatic, it's a little unhappy, it's strange. Of course, the life of Weinberg was not so successful than the life of Prokofiev, for example, or also the Shostakovich, no? But especially more contrast with Prokofiev, no? And I think all of these things is there, all the memories of his family that was killed by the Nazis in the Treblinka, camp. No, it's something that must be there, never recognized for the country, for the society. Always composing 22 symphonies, but nobody played it. It's something more dark in some point of view. But at the same time, it's so much sometimes. It's the first and last movement. It's, wow, energy, tremendous energy. And I can imagine with Gideon Kremer, this would be perfect for him, no? And we go also to another, in some point of view, for the moment of the symphony, with the symphony number 4, than Tchaikovsky recognized then I was married, and it's one of my more horrible decisions. This was this moment when he composed this, no? You see, I did the disaster doing this marriage, no? And at the same time, it's plenty of unhappiness in this symphony and this melancholic Tchaikovsky. Then must be something in the society. Then he like to be something himself, no? And it's this really problem of the destiny that demand you to go to one place, and you don't like to go to this place, no? It's for this, it's for the Prokofiev with the happiness. We go to the another two really dark composers.
That's a really great way to talk it through. Yeah, that's a nice way of sort of different angles on our own experiences of happiness or trying to fit in, whatever. And you know, the Prokofiev and the Tchaikovsky are both pieces that the orchestra plays on a regular basis. So when you come in as the guest conductor, the BSO always is ready to do whatever they need to with a conductor. But how long does it take to recalibrate and sort of get on the same page with tempos and dynamics and all of that? How long does it take for something like the Tchaikovsky 4 to settle in and be exactly how you all want to do it?
The amazing thing and the wonderful thing is that they know very well the piece, and you start in so high level. No? This is very good, no? than the work is done in some point of view. No? But always it's difficult to see the score, no? And to know what is written by Tchaikovsky, because sometimes in the Tchaikovsky symphonies, conductors, we put a lot of things inside of us. No? And here, this ritenuto, and this diminuendo, and this accent, and this... Sorry, it's written in the score? No. Why not to try to understand what is written in the score and try to play, no? It's for this, of course, sometimes the symphonies play very fast. We're not trying to rehearsal go to the concert, one rehearsal go, no? Okay, but when you take this in the season series, okay, you must look better, no? We discovered there today, this is suito less sound than before because it's written forte, before was 3 Fs. Okay, and we didn't remark this, okay? And often people play here louder, or this accent, or this ritenuto, or this, now is the moment is in the second movement, in the last moment with the violin, take the theme of the boy. Now the woodwinds don't have these accents, than they have when it's with oboe. Why? Because now is another direction of the music for him, more dreaming, not so real sound. No? Of course, it's for me always take a little time to discover all these things, but the best thing is, the best arm that I have is written. And I told them, but it's written, no? And all of them, yes, of course, it's written. Okay, but okay, we can try to do it.
Well, that's great. I'm looking forward to hearing it, and I appreciate your time taking a few minutes to talk about it today. Thank you.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. Thanks.
That's Juanjo Mena, who conducts the Boston Symphony Orchestra this weekend, and you can hear the concert live on the air at 8 p.m. on Saturday night. On Sunday this weekend, it's more orchestral music on WCRB in concert. Richard Egar leads the Period Instrument Orchestra of the Handel and Haydn Society in Mendelssohn's Symphony No. 4, the Italian Symphony, and Beethoven's Symphony No. 3, the Eroica, recorded at Symphony Hall last October. That's when I got together with Richard Egar backstage at the hall, and I asked him about what it's like to perform those two particular pieces on one program.
They are, in a way, incredibly similar pieces in that they require an enormous amount of energy, but they give you and take from you completely different things. I mean, the Mendelssohn is just so open, and it gives you a lot of energy. It's playing it, it's conducting it, it's sort of physically quite invigorating for the players, and particularly the woodwinds. Whereas the Eroica, it requires total energy. You cannot get away with anything less in that symphony. It is just monumental. I mean, just coming back to it again for this project, it just makes me realize how massive this piece is, and people must have just been overwhelmed. I just don't think they got it. I mean, it didn't get a particularly good reaction. I just don't think they just got it. It wasn't possible. I mean, and he'd had a number of tryouts of the symphony in privately with the prince. So it can't have been a bad performance, or, well, we assume it wasn't a bad performance, but it requires an enormous amount of energy. I mean, 50 minutes of full on, and even in this funeral march, which hasn't got the speed of the other movements, but it requires a depth of energy which will leave us completely exhausted, I'm sure.
Well, so there are also pieces that are familiar from symphony orchestra concerts from practically the moment they were born, we'll say. But these days, with a period instrument band like H&H, what is it that we're hearing in these that might get a little obscured with the more modern performances that people know?
Well, again, the sort of the internal balancing is helped by the fact that the winds and the strings, the winds have more of a chance to come through with fewer numbers of strings. The brass isn't so massive. It's very reedy, particularly in the Mendelssohn. He uses very high trumpets in the last two movements. It's a very special color, so it turns up the treble on the amplifier. So again, just the instruments themselves give it a very different balance within the music. I wouldn't say it was necessarily always easier, because the thing about the Eroica is that it is so, there's so much going on, particularly in the last movement. And even the first movement is even with old instruments, you have to be very careful with balancing, making sure that things can be heard. So it's not a cure-all. Playing on old instruments is never a cure-all, particularly in the Eroica, but also in the Mendelssohn Italian as well. There are loads of places in the first movement where the bass group has thematic material, and the winds and the brass are screaming on top of them, fortissimo. And it's again, you have to be careful, even in something that's as well written and brilliantly orchestrated as the Italian. It still requires a bit of care.
Sure, yeah. No, I always think of period instruments maybe being a little bit on the upper side of the difficulty spectrum, just because they're kind of they can be cranky.
Yeah.
And so what we hear when we're used to a piece that we hear in a modern orchestra sometimes does have this grainy quality, but that it ramps up that energy that you've talked
about. Well, it does. I mean, again, particularly it's something like the Eroica and something like Schubert 9, when you play those pieces on old instruments, it's like Beethoven with his piano music. It's pushing the limits of what these instruments can do, or actually can't do. So that's also makes it incredibly exciting.
Is there something that in the Mendelssohn that you can, is there something we would hear that we would then think, oh, right, because Beethoven did the Eroica, Mendelssohn does this?
I wouldn't necessarily say that there was a reaction in the Italian symphony to the Eroica. It's just he was trying to sort of, in a way, it's more Mozartian than it is Beethoven. It's a much lighter piece of music. So I think he was. I mean, when you take something like the Reformation symphony, then it's a different kettle of fish. But the Italian is. It's a bit of spring fresh air, a complete opposite end of the spectrum from the Eroica, but yet has this energy crisis that they both share.
Yeah. When you did that Italian chamber concert last year, we talked some about, because it was you and how many more, there were maybe four or five other people you were working with.
People, yeah.
So you had lots of conversation with them, and that was a lot of music that was almost unknown.
Yeah.
How different is the collaboration with the players when you're dealing with this large an ensemble?
It's no different. I mean, one of the things I always try and do, whatever music I'm doing with whatever size, it should remain chamber music, and it can. Although, again, when you're talking about the Eroica, it's not. But you have to be aware. You must make everybody aware of what's going on and talk to each other. So I use the same approach. I don't do anything differently when I'm conducting a symphony.
Well, Richard Egar, thanks for taking a few minutes to talk with me, and welcome back to Boston.
Thank you very much. Enjoy.
Richard Egar is the music director of the Academy of Ancient Music in London and the guest conductor of the concert you'll hear this Sunday night at 7 on WCRB in concert with the Handel and Haydn Society. And after Sunday night, you'll be able to hear that concert on demand at our website, classicalwcrb.org. And now for a bonus track. When I talked with Juanjo Mena this week, as you heard, we really only talked about this week's program. But last summer at Tanglewood, he and I had a longer conversation in which we got into some bigger picture topics about his work with the BBC Philharmonic and about his native country of Spain. It was on a weekend when he was conducting two concerts, which you'll also hear about in this interview, and which you can still hear on demand at our website. Here's our conversation. Your two concerts involve three different guest soloists, and I just want to ask you real quickly about each of them, whether you've worked with them before and what you find in their playing, or in one case their singing, that is really special. So Garrick Olson with the Tchaikovsky First Piano Concerto. Have you worked with Garrick before?
We did a lot of things together in the last 10 years, and we have a very good friends, and we did beautiful programs with Chopin, with his specialist in this piece. But also we did Barber Concerto, for example, in BBC, with my BBC Philharmonic in Manchester. And this was also amazing. So to have this type of pianist that is so solid, so stable, so a big musician at the same time. No? And now to do Tchaikovsky also with the only things that Tchaikovsky grow, what to say, no extra things than always we put in the music. No? And he's perfect for this. Also. I am very happy to be here.
And he's here every summer. And so the audience, he's part of the fabric, so it makes it maybe a little extra.
You choose very well in this case.
That's true. On the same concert, Raquel Lojendo is singing the soprano part for the Three-Cornered Hat, and you even recorded this piece with her. So tell me about your relationship with Raquel and what she brings to that role.
It's strange because she's a soprano, really, but he's singing now the part of the mezzo-soprano, but he has a special color and dark color that work very well, because this is only little three little moments in the ballet that she must sing, but one of them is very high, and always with the mezzo-sopranos you have problems, and another one is very low. But this woman have the capacity to have this contrast and dark sound, and also the pronunciation, the pronunciation of the text, the Andalusi pronunciation is amazing, it's wonderful. He knows very well, he has family and also in Andalusi, and it's very evident. It's for this I recorded at the end with her, because I think it's the more, and at the moment, one of the better singers for this.
Yeah. On Sunday, Veronica Eberle is the soloist for a Mozart concerto, and I haven't heard her playing before. Tell me about it.
For me, it's the first time with her. I listen to some other recordings, and I think she chooses very well what to do here with this Mozart concerto, no? Because she's very young, also is growing up now, and she's still with this academy things that is very, very good for Mozart, no? Very, you know, very good technique, very focused technique, and I think it would be fine.
Yeah. Faya's Three-Cornered Hat is a piece with so much freedom built into it. And there's not a lot of time at Tanglewood. That's one of the defining things about Tanglewood. There's just not a lot of time to put things together. Does that make it a harder piece to do at Tanglewood than, say, in a subscription week when you'd have four rehearsals?
I think so. This is a very, very complex piece. It's because the orchestra know the suites, also know with they play it here with one of the best conductors for this music, that was Maestro Fribe de Burgos. No? Okay, it's very clear when I take the suites that they remember all the things that they worked with him, and I recognize the style of so Friedrich in this. But the rest of the ballet, that is a lot of time, is all is new, and each bar is moving, is playing to the details, to the character of the corregidor, to the character of the miller's wife, is playing of the details, change bars, accelerandos, tempis, ritenutos, and it's very complex to have the picture, no? It's for this my type of work today, also first day, was sometimes you are doing from beginning to the end, and anytime you discover new change, new thing, and this is at the end is, you know, it's also something that is very complex for a musician. What I do sometimes, and I did also today, is start for the end. You know where you are. You came back some bars before in the new tempo, and when you arrive to the passage that you did before, you recognize and you establish a connection about the tempi change, no? And go is to start in the end and go to beginning. This is the best thing to do in these very difficult ballets. I did exactly the same when we did Wooden Prince Bartok in Symphony Hall, because it's quasi the same, and it's very useful, I think.
That's a great technique. I never would have thought of doing that. So that's pretty cool. Yet I also know that you have conducted this piece with choreography, with dancers. And do you feel just more freedom when it's only a concert presentation? I shouldn't say only, but when it is a concert presentation, is it just a little bit easier not to deal with the dancers?
Of course, it's easier, no? But the question is, when the dancers are with us, the musician understand much better all the music. No, this was amazing. When I invest, I think 15 years ago, two malls in Italy in a little theater, doing with a flamenco company, 2 weeks working the ballet. And I was there each day knowing each little detail, you know. I recognize all the things that is written in the, exactly the situations in the stage, you know. And when the dancers are there, immediately the orchestra changed the type of sound and have more character. I try to translate the musicians today without the dances. I dance sometimes, but it's very difficult. But it's true. In some point of view, I can be more free, a little more free.
Yeah, but I never really thought. I even played in a ballet orchestra once, and I never really thought about how that would energize the players in a different way when they see or hear that kind of thing going on.
It was amazing because I recorded with BBC, without, of course, without ballet. But later we did in the proms. That is a beautiful. It's also on YouTube. You can see. It's amazing. You understand the history. It's not only dancers. They had actors also, and it's amazing. It was the Royal Albert Hall was really crazy, and also they were crazy at the end. And also we do as encore, Bolero de Ravel with flamenco dancers.
Oh my God!
And this is another history.
That sounds like a lot of fun. Wow. Well, on Sunday, you're conducting Variaciones Concertantes by Alberto Ginastera. And I wonder what it is about that piece that makes it the right choice to commemorate his centenary. It's for his 100th birthday. And what is it about that piece that really says something about Ginastera?
I think it's very good choice by Tony, no? Because really it's a very difficult piece with a lot of solo. Each member of the orchestra have a so complicated, very difficult solo, and this is the orchestra that can do it. When we started another day in rehearsal, and I start listening to the solo, the cello say, "Oh, never I saw this level." Alto later, "Wow," and clarinet, you know, each one of them this was on so high level. I think it's good piece because it's also in the moment of the transition of Ginastera, but not so strong as the last words than, for example, the violin concerto that was premiered. And in for the open of the Lincoln Center with Bernstein in New York, or also another piano concertos that were later, is very complex, very quasi dodecaphonic, and very. I think this is a good piece also to recognize so high level in the transition of the progression of Ginastera.
It has some echoes of Stravinsky, doesn't it?
Yes, true. You can listen a little of the Oedipus Rex, and also the feeling of the instrumentation is also quasi the same, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. There are so many ways that conductors approach Beethoven now. I don't know if it's because so many people conduct Beethoven that appears so often. Is there any particular model that you sort of look to for Beethoven symphonies, or how do you find your way, particularly with the Symphony No. 6?
Okay, all of us, we did Beethoven's, but so it's so difficult to do good Beethoven. For example, my orchestra proposed me for the next season in BBC Philharmonic to do Eroica, Beethoven 3, and say, no, I am not ready to do this symphony at the moment. I am not ready. I need more time to understand the piece. I don't know. Sometimes it's your proper evolutions, your evolution is different, and you can serve different point of view. Okay, in my case, when I was studying in Munich with Maestro Celibidache, I was two weeks, listening rehearsals of Maestro Celibidache working Beethoven 6, 2 weeks. You know, you cannot imagine what was the quality of the marvelous things that I was able to understand there. I was shocked, no? And I am very happy because in some American orchestras, when I did Beethoven 6, they are, no, it's too slow. No, this needs more energetic, because also some reviews here was, why not after the Beethoven 5, Beethoven 6 must continue the line. What do you say? Beethoven 6 is another picture. It's another history. It's not a reference about something before 5. No, it's nothing about this. And this is the best place to do this symphony, in the countryside, in so quiet city, in so quiet ambient, in so nice orchestra. And I was very happy yesterday when I start rehearsal, I established my tempos, and all of them understand, and this is the way to do this music. No faster, no exciting, no crazy. Now our life is changing a lot. All must be exciting, all must be crazy, all must be, you know, why? In this time was not this idea.
Yeah, yeah. That's That's really interesting. I mean, I guess I had forgotten that Chelyabinsky was part of your experience, and he was a conductor with sort of special powers that other conductors didn't seem to have, I guess. Tell me a little bit about your work with the BBC Philharmonic. You've been with them for a while now. And what is it, I guess we don't really understand probably on this side of the Atlantic, what distinguishes the various British orchestras? What do you feel like that orchestra does really, really well? What is it that makes them special?
It's also very good in America, but there, the first reading is amazing. It's also, what you say, the honor that they have at 10 o'clock when you put any symphony in the pult, to say, I know what is this piece, I play this piece very well, I know any little detail in the piece, I will be looking at you, also waiting in the clarinet. You know, this is the attitude of them, to have, you know, a power inside to say, I know. And the ensemble is amazing. The first reading sometimes, and for this is quasi a sport, what to say. They like to do from beginning to the end, the first moment, and look at you and say, what we must do now. You know, it's true, it's as a team, it's amazing, the respect, the ensemble in the sections, it's also very good in America, so the readings here is much better than in another part of Europe, but in England especially is this. And also, why is this? Because they do, you know, I am exhausted after 5-6 years with this orchestra. We did sometimes 3 programs by week, you know. And all of them is with the recordings, and you know the pressure is there always. You know, we must do very quickly the things, and if we do 3 programs in a week, this is like to say that we do 3 times more the repertoire than another orchestras. And this happened, for example, when it's a guest conducted and Nielsen 6 or 9 or any Nielsen, you know, or any piece different, strange. Okay, they go there to my orchestra and the orchestra know the piece because they record it, they play it, they, you know, it's a very good, it's a bibliotheque, it's a librarian there. It's, all of them know very well the music.
That, it makes it sound like it's the pace of Tanglewood, but just all the time.
Yeah, it's true. This is, it's similar to, but can you imagine? Not only in summer, no, but all the weeks.
Time.
This is amazing.
I'm curious about one other thing, if I can ask. When we talked before, we talked a little about coming from Spain, studying in Germany, being around a lot. But I'm curious to go back to talk a little bit about Spain and the audience's relationship to concert music, to classical music. Spain has a very different recent history from a lot of the rest of Europe, a very tough history. And I guess I just wonder, do you feel like, first of all, from the sort of distant past, there was Franco, and then much more recently, there was grave economic difficulty in Spain. And it really made people's lives hard. Do you feel like those times make this kind of music a little bit, I don't know, more valuable, more important to Spanish audiences?
I think so. After the death of Franco, we look each other and say, okay, we must do all. You know, it was nothing there. It was only little orchestra, 2 orchestras with very good problems, you know, and a lot of problems and nothing, no auditoriums, no. Okay, always. We are open the door for all this amazing music, you know, that is in front. It's for this I am very happy because I was living this moment. I was 11 years old when Franco died, and this transition to open the doors and to look all this culture outside was amazing. Was part of my life, you know, and I am a result of this, you know. And you know now in Spain they are in quasi each city amazing auditoriums, beautiful auditoriums. They build a new orchestras, the youth national orchestras, and also the School of Music. This was a grow up amazing because we were needing to do, because before it was nothing. You know, it was only the wind vans in the village, you know, no more than this. It's for this, the progression was amazing in the last 25 years. But what happened with, as we were living in a war that was not real, no? We suppose that we can have, you know, money, very easy for the banks to buy this and buy this, always open. It's, for us, was, you know, open the door to a disaster in some point of view. That is magical, but it's disaster. And this came later, no, with the crisis, and we reduce all this attention to the culture. But and at the moment, still a lot of good focus center. Then I think it's impossible to change now after the time of Franco.
Yeah, that's very encouraging. That's great. Well, thank you, Juan Jomena, for a little bit of time today, and I'm looking forward to your Symphony Hall concert that's coming up next season.
January, yes, true.
Yeah. Thanks for your time today.
It's a big pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
Again, the two concerts Juan Jomena conducted at Tanglewood last summer are available to hear on demand at our website, classicalwcrb.org. And tune in this weekend on Saturday night at 8 p.m. for our live broadcast of the Boston Symphony with Juan Jomena. You can subscribe to The Answered Question at iTunes or through your favorite podcast app, and you'll also find TAQ at WCRB's Facebook, Twitter, and SoundCloud pages. Thank you to Juan Jomena and Richard Egar, as well as the staffs of the Boston Symphony and the Handel and Haydn Society for making these conversations possible. I'm Brian McCreath. Thanks for listening.